This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 009. On the show today, I'm delighted to welcome William Lawrence, who is a rare bird in the fintech world as he is already onto his second fintech business in a scene where many people are just starting for the first time. He co-founded Ixaris in 2002, a prepaid Visa and MasterCard provider which was well ahead of its time, and led it through many funding rounds and substantial increases in business. He's currently co-founder and COO of Quanji, which aims to make international business easier for SMEs, a worthy goal. Quanji has been featured in Wired, the BBC, The Times, and Forbes, as well as now the pinnacle of their fame in the London FinTech Podcast. Their first product is Quanji FX, a foreign exchange price comparison site which puts SMEs on the same footing as large companies in terms of the exchange rates and payment functionality they can get. It describes itself as a dating service for FX, which reminds me of Matchy.biz being a dating service for innovation. Certainly, the internet needs these matching services to connect, in essence, buyers and sellers much more cheaply and more transparently than we could ever have done before. We will tune into Quanji later in the show, but the main theme that will be of value to the community is to hear about what it is like in the early stages of a fintech. Tech firm creation stories tend to end up as some glossy myth of the hero slaying the dragon. It's only when it ends up in court or in sexual harassment suits that the more, non-linear realpolitik emerges. So I hope William can share some of the tales of scraped knees, Brownian motion, and resolve which eventually gets you through the lean early years. So let's get on with the show. Hi, William. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. It's great to talk to you today after our various encounters on the London networking scene. I'm excited to be your ninth participant in this wonderful set of recordings and share my experiences of the two fintech startups I've done to date.
Great. And I'm glad I paid you a tenner beforehand to say something so nice about the FinTech Podcast. This is my latest theme. Going forward, I'll have to pay people more and more money.
Yeah, exactly.
Until I've got someone peeling me grapes. Probably on episode 1000. So before we get into the meat of the show, William, how come you are in fintech today?
It was fairly obvious from probably seven or so that I was into tech, maths, science, that kind of end of things. So there was a fairly easy choice through A-levels and uni, which then becomes a little less predictable and a little less planned in order of how I actually ended up in fintech.
So what did you do at university then?
At university was Imperial and a mix of electronic engineering and the MBA content done in the first degree.
Oh, right.
And so the MBA with the joyous things like the German brewing industry and Harley Davidson as case studies taught by the MBA school was far more ongoing use to me, I feel, than the technology specifics.
That's interesting, actually. I don't know how many education providers are listening to the show, but increasingly everything that's done at university ends up having to be situated in some kind of commercial context. And as we all know, we meet lots of folks who had a narrow tech background, and they may be very good at tech, but then they really struggle when they've got to go into the parameters of a business. So even if you studied old style bricks and mortar businesses, if it's such like Harley Davidson, that's a really useful background to the fintech scene.
Well, yes, all the commercial issues there. My course actually was probably a primer for people to go into investment banking and the old school banking at the kind of dot-com boom era, 98, 99, before the modernish world of alternative fintech startups existed. And a lot of people did that. Others, you know, chip design, anything more technical than I ended up at.
Yeah.
I ended up at a management consultancy that actually sponsored me for university.
Okay.
The lucky days of all fees paid by the government for your education at uni and as paid yet more by the company concerned, which was Arthur D. Little, a American parented high technology management consultancy. I was working for the Cambridge UK, a part of that.
Yes, I remember them well because talking about maths at school, a buddy of mine who I met when I sat next to him at the age of 11 in a maths lesson was head of telecoms in London in the late 1990s for Arthur D. Little. And in terms of the usual career roller coasters that we all go through once we've been at it for a few decades, that sounded rather good. And he was a very busy boy and flying around when telecoms was a really big thing.
Yeah.
And it was all quite good until Arthur D. Little went bust owing him his pension fund and a bunch of bonuses and other things like that, where it appeared to be less of a good idea.
Well, I suppose that's the first bit of my, if not fintech, but tech experience, was the whole dot-com hype, including in that company where they tried to list on NASDAQ just at the end of 2001, yeah, as it was crashing 4% a week plus, and $12 to $15 million of cost later failed to list going into a consultancy recession in 2002 anyway, ultimately ended up going bankrupt. And that's where actually first fintech startup called Exaris in early 2002 starts from.
That's interesting, actually. The death of one thing leads to the birth of another. So how did the phoenix arise from the ashes? Or rather, a small phoenix and very big ashes, I guess.
Yeah, it's one of those moments where you've got to get yourself in a kind of personal circumstances position to be able to take the leap of faith and lose the full salary. So despite that company going bankrupt, the whole group had been offered a move to another management consultancy at the same rates, about 15 people. Two of us decided not to do it, Alex and myself, and go off to something that had been a rough and ready idea and try and execute it into what became Exaris.
So those were early days, because I went indie in 1998 and literally no one else did. And it was a crazy thing to do in those times. You know, even though it was the dot-com boom, not a lot of that stuff was happening in the city other than hedge funds, perhaps. So 2002 is pretty early days for the pre-fintech scene, for example.
Yes.
You probably didn't have many friends. Well, I mean, you probably had lots of friends, but you probably didn't have many other companies around you.
No, we were very early in the particular sector, this kind of Visa, MasterCard, prepay world that now is pretty common.
It's huge, yeah.
But no, I was thinking more about how you get into that space. So personal circumstances, this is one of those things for people out there listening, if they've got an idea for their own fintech startup, kind of setting up your life circumstances around it. This has happened to me twice, both on Exaris and on the second business, of financial dependence or not. In the first case, property you've got to pay for and so on. So it's always that issue of, are you free of enough strings to take the leap of faith, really?
Yes, that's interesting. So there is a bias there towards being relatively young because you don't have half a dozen kids and school fees and yada, yada, yada to pay for.
Yes, I think that's true. However, there's a conundrum, isn't it? Because it manifests itself, if you look across the London new wave fintech scene, it is quite young and, for what it's worth, very male. Kind of one single cultural group apart from Kwanji and my co-founder, Leslie. We will come on to that story.
Oh, right,
there's
a woman around. I should have interviewed her. I've been sort of desperate for a woman, which I probably should rephrase on the London fintech podcast.
So I'm going to show you...
show me a woman.
So no, I'm not going to show you a woman. I'm going to show you Leslie in the beanie hat.
Oh, right.
Who's sat behind us. Who's a bloke.
It's a bloke.
Leslie with an IE.
Well, for those of you who aren't in the fintech scene, you won't necessarily appreciate the irony that it is about 1 in 100 women. I've never been anywhere with so few women in it, but we'll come on to that another time. Yeah. So in terms of Exaris, then what was the journey there? And going back to the theme I was saying earlier, what is it like inside a fintech startup in the early years?
First of all, I guess one point to make is somebody has the genesis of the idea, others typically execute around them, and that's been my pattern in both Exaris and now Kwanji. So Alex was a university supervisor, had a final year star pupil, which technically was the genesis of what became Exaris. So you don't need to be the one, and not the one, who has the bright idea. I'm the executions guy, the operations officer.
I was hoping you're the one who had the idea, because that sounds much easier. Like, oh, I'll be the guy who has the idea, and you guys go and do all the work.
Well, no, I'm the one who does all the work. Oh, saying that...
Maybe on the third one, you could be the one that has the idea, and then just other people do all the work.
Well, I think Alex worked harder than I did, actually.
Oh,
but there we go. So yeah, you know, you execute, you don't have much money, you sit in... That was in my attic room in my small terraced house at the time. You don't really have office premises. In that era, in 2002, the whole kind of cloud-based software infrastructure that supports easier startup nowadays wasn't there. So you did have to go hire servers in racks and do that kind of element yourself. It didn't seem that hard because there was a third guy called Damon, CTO, who did that world. A bigger burden to get the thing started. And then you've got to have people who believe and keep them believing, even whilst you might be about to run out of money and so on.
Yes. And so that's interesting because a lot of people in the scene do come out with this soundbite that it's now 10 times cheaper than it was 10 years ago. But actually, there are very few people who were doing it 10 years ago.
I'm not entirely convinced the 10 times multiple is real.
Right.
Meaning in both businesses, it's labour, it's the cost of people.
Yes.
That's through and through, you know, 80%, 90% plus of your cost base. So actually, to me, that's a much more important bit than the hardware and the software that you're using.
Indeed. And everybody seems to complain to me these days that there's a shortage of good developers in London, despite the large number of people one meets. So if you're out there looking for a gig and looking for a job, then I think you can do worse than converting yourself into a developer at somewhere like Makers Academy that I hear nothing but good things about, which I think they run a 3-month program and they've got something like 100% success rate of people they churn out at the end. It's interesting actually because in episode 005, when I came to write up the blog, John Volmer was saying on the one hand it's easier and on the other hand it's not easier now. So it's always more complex than the black and white, which it tends to be presented in the sort of superficial social media or the sort of superficial articles one reads in the sort of the Evening Standard or something. I'm not being critical of the Evening Standard. It's just that people have to take a fairly surface view of something, which is actually a very complex phenomenon once you drill down into it.
Yeah, and going back to the development thing, again, we've got Exaris versus Quanji there. Both are using offshore, still using offshore dev teams. However, the Exaris example was actually co-founder Alex's Maltese by birth, hence we had a Maltese dev team and there's still quite a lot of people,
okay, 50 used Maltesers.
Yeah, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Probably wasn't the first one.
They really don't enjoy that.
No, I'm sure. I didn't enjoy Maltesers, actually.
Whilst they were direct employees, we had offshore software dev in Malta way before it became relatively common. It's now a lot more common, actually, because it's a whitelisted jurisdiction for gambling websites, hence they all put their development teams in there.
Oh, I wondered why their team's done that. So what experiences or what was the most value from the Exaris experience for you looking back? I mean, everything leads to something else. So, you know, you're at a company, mm-hmm. you're still relatively young, the thing's blowing up, and you say, oh dear, what do I do next? And then this thing comes along, and each time you go through the difficulties, there is this saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but it's not necessarily the case, it can also make you weaker. But what do you take away from Exaris? I mean, if you hadn't done Exaris, what would you be lacking now in terms of software modules or experience of business or fintech?
Well, quite a few. Let me try and break them down. Yeah. This is four or five layers to the onion of the answer on that. But I think the first thing, fundamentally, it's perhaps a bit trite and obvious to say, is the whole kind of structure and logic of building a business and how it interacts and how it works and managing people, investors, both fundraising and managing the people who come and sit in your board meetings and grump at you. So yeah, to me, that's probably the most complex bit. And in all of it, it's hiring the right people, keeping them interested and so on. That's absolutely the trickiest bit, but that's the core of the business, any kind of intellectual property business. So Exaris has had a whole wave of hiring, obviously has serious churn, has a kind of core of 10 people out of the 100 now who've been there pretty much since day one. So you get the trusted inner circle, and I've seen that in a lot of businesses who stick and stick and stick and probably are quite well incentivized on their options, if not shares. And then around them, you're going to have to hire different people. Salespeople, demand side people have always been the trickiest. But whilst I love my salespeople, I think you've got to have it's a character that's flirtatious, you know, a flitty in its very nature, which can make them impossible to manage. And you don't know if they're going to be any good despite their supposed track record until you hire them.
And I'm just thinking back to my origins working in 1983 in a tech startup in Bath. I was something like number 12 after 3 or 6 months. 18 months later, I left and there were 55 in the company. Very rapid growth. And one of the problems that they faced, which I think is sort of fairly common to tech startups of that era, but the problem still applies these days, is that the early guys get given 0.1% of shares or 1% of shares each or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then if the business is growing in the old style way, which they did, i.e. growing revenue, then somebody joins a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, they end up having a much smaller equity stake. So it's really challenging problem, which is it's very easy to kind of tie in your first ones, but if you're really going somewhere, the later ones have got less of a stake by definition, and then they're somehow not in the club.
But usually that's a trade-off. Yes, I can see how that can be divisive, but that's usually a trade-off that the people in the early days take the higher risk, if only because they haven't got market rate salaries.
Yeah.
I suppose that's another bit where, as an example, I was 50%, if not less, of market rate in the early days of Exaris.
Yeah. Yeah.
It climbed to full rate, and then I had the circumstances to go back to Quanji. It's a third of what it was at Exaris. So
this does relate to your
trade-off.
It does relate to your point about your personal circumstances have to line up to be able to take pay cuts of a third and that kind of thing. Well, anyway, it's a tricky area. And I was talking to a fintech recently, and they're somewhat having, quote, frank internal conversations around the shareholding of the founder and then the early people and the later people and all that kind of stuff. And that comes back to the point about managing the people, the external investors, the internal ones. And then you also mentioned the salesman, and I know what you mean in terms of gut feel. Vice versa, I do see many fintechs who lack any kind of slight MBA or slight businessy background, who kind of build something and say, oh yeah, now what we need is a salesman to go and sell it.
And I think
and they've kind of built something in their garden shed. The bloke doesn't sell it for a whole bunch of valid reasons, even if he's the world's super salesman. And they go, oh, the salesman's no good, we'll get another one.
I think you've got the first few sales, both at Exaris and Quanji, are sales by which I could mean critical business partnerships too, biz dev sale, are always done by the founders.
You've got to do it yourself, exactly.
You would understand what the hell it is you're actually selling.
Exactly, because if you can't sell it, nobody else can.
Yeah, so Exaris got its lucky break when there were about 5 people, and we sold prepay functionality to one big FTSE 100 business for various uses in the UK. Quanji really got its lucky break in terms of that's business partnerships more with its FX partners. Got its lucky break when Leslie, actually, before I joined, got the first one to say yes, and then you can build out.
Interesting. Coming on to the other point, which is always a challenge for people, which is managing the external investors and the need to get capital into the company. And that's always something which is hard work to get the money, hard work to get the right investors.
How much can you really pick and choose your investors? It depends if you're an absolutely hot
ticket. You read all the sort of blogs, oh, you want smart money. Yeah, sure, yeah. You know, I want the weather to be nice as well.
Yeah, well, it gets easier when you do it the second time around too, because you've got your network, you've got a bunch of people who did their own fintech businesses that have exited and want to help you and, you know, recycle angel-type money into you. That's one
end of it. Which is starting to get like the values, which is there are people who did what you did and they've been doing it for 20 years and they've got excess cash and they want to recycle it.
Yes, but it's not Valley-style numbers, I don't think, on the angel side. You'd probably take a zero off despite the US dollar sterling difference anyway. But yeah, that is starting to happen. That certainly happened to us in Quanji's. Some of the most valuable kind of value-added investors we've got of the five or six so far are people who exited and have very good contact networks for us to call upon. Going back on the sales front, I've got a wonderful anecdote for you in terms of hiring. So hiring salespeople is the trickiest thing, and we have a wonderful story at Exaris where we hired a certain sales lady without doing the Googling in advance, when Google was a relatively new idea that you'd Google an employee. So about a week after she joined, one of our young and base male techies goes, have you Googled her? Look at result 4, which turns out to be topless modeling on a bridge over a motorway, not even in a very...
Oh, fantastic.
A very fascinating, not in a very wonderful background.
Exotic scenery.
And we had to think, and given she was selling to a particular base male industry, we thought, oh, that's fine.
We'll leave it.
But yeah, so that wasn't actually a problem. But yeah, there can be interesting surprises with hiring people.
We're going back to one of the themes of today, which is sort of lack of women in the world. It does make me think that I've never actually seen on any of my contacts LinkedIn information page 3 modeling.
Well, yes, she's gone off to do more of it since, actually.
Oh, but good for her. Good for her. It's probably easier than being in fintech.
Well, yes, indeed.
Well, of course, there's an easy joke going there, which is it's a bit like being in fintech because the VCs will take the shirt off your back. Boom.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Well, you quite like VCs, though, don't you?
We've tend to taken it from the slightly lower layers to date. Quanji is running up middle of next year for its kind of full Series A, and we're in the early stage, join the dots discussions with what would be the famous kind of London set and beyond of VCs. Exaris's history is more VCTs, which is a smaller ticket size with its tax breaks, ultimately.
EIS, SEIS.
Well, and VCT tax breaks, similar in nature. Tends to be a slightly smaller size. And Exaris has actually had the most money from a super angel, a very big shareholder in the likes of Betfair, and made his money originally from starting a pretty successful management consultancy.
So we've got the external shareholders, you've got the internal staff, you've got the hiring of salespersons, and I guess you've got the just kind of sheer dogged determination.
Yes, and you have the parlance didn't exist, but the number of pivots you need to make, you know, the lean startup terminology.
Yeah, I hate lean startup.
Well, the terminology, some of it's quite useful. Product market fit, if you ask me. And pivoting to get it is a useful concept. That didn't exist conceptually in Exaris, but we did have, you know, a year and a half to 2 years at the early stages of pivot, change. And we probably had a similar bit before we really got traction and teeth into the market with Quanji until about February, March this year.
I think one of the things that I don't like about the lean startup, which for those who don't know about it, it's a rather famous book written a few years ago by a guy who'd his business basically spent 6 or 9 months building something rather complicated, only to find it didn't sell. So he wrote this book, which is saying, well, hang on, find out whether it's going to sell in the first place. And in the most trivial way, you could just have a website which says, click here for information. If nobody clicks on it, you know they're not interested, so you don't have to build it. The problem is when you get to, quote, real businesses like fintechs or like FX, I don't think it really applies. If you're going to go out there and find your first client or first partner, you've got to show that you've got the ability to have something that works. You send me an app and it doesn't transfer my money to euros, I'm not going to be very happy.
No, you can still spoof to various degrees in terms of things around the actual transaction. So customer service can be very manually operated behind the scenes and so on. So
you're still delivering on your promise to actually deliver, as it were.
Yes, so Exaris prepay card issuing, you have to go get an issuing bank. Yeah. That's a hell of a big sell. It still is, actually. That hasn't changed in terms of being particularly more easy to get nowadays. Quanji, you have to go and persuade a panel of FX partners that they want to list with you, and there's a value proposition and so on in all of it.
So coming on to Quanji then, what does Quanji do? As I said in the outset, you're aiming to make international business easier for SMEs. You're starting off with an FX price comparison or dating site. If I'm an SME and I'm out there, why should I be interested in Quanji?
SMEs have varying degrees of sophistication. So there's anything from the one man or woman band who haven't thought beyond their bank, where, hey, there's a bloody great cost saving if you switch from your bank to an alternative supplier, to the more sophisticated financial controller who already might be using alternative FX brokers and maybe one or two of them and has to call around for quotes. So there's different benefits for different customers. Fundamentally, it's about cost and price comparison and easy integration into your online accounting software or e-invoicing packages if you use them.
And how many years has Quanji been going now?
Quanji as a concept in the bloke Leslie's mind has been going for 2 years or so on, and it stems from Leslie Onyezo, as the name might suggest, Nigerian heritage, although Brit born. 20 years ago was successfully doing international trade across borders in Eastern Africa. Hell of a hassle, lots of problems with payments, customs, paperwork, letters of credit, etc. Goes away, does other things, comes back to it more recently. No one has fundamentally solved this problem. It's a big vision, you've got to start somewhere, hence the Quanji FX, the payment itself. And so yes, it's a comparison website. Dating is quite a good word, where you pick your best partner based on maybe flirtatious things, purely like price, but also on functionality and features. If you need to get a payment, for example, somebody today is doing Burkina Faso. Everybody can deliver to Burkina Faso.
So I happen to know a guy who's got a great business importing fresh herbs for Waitrose from Kenya, and he's got the monopoly on it.
Oh, there you go. Well, I'd like to talk to you about that.
Oh, right. Okay. You're a special price. Well, as you were so nice to me about the introduction, or nice to the podcast, I'm sure I can help out there. And the thing about fresh herbs, of course, is that you need a very short logistical chain, because otherwise they're not very fresh.
Yeah.
You also need the cash flowing down. So I don't know how they can do it. I mean, obviously, you can put you guys in touch. And then the other thing, which I was interested about Quanji, because I hadn't picked this up before, which is that compared to the average young fintech, you're actually quite large, and there's about 20 of you.
Yeah.
So you're becoming more like a company in a way.
Well, there's 20 people, yes.
Which is quite a lot of management, going back to keeping all the guys happy and motivated and pointing in the right direction.
Yeah, we just had a big growth offer for recent funding round. So we've added substantially to the demand side, i.e. the marketing and sales people. That's all started late August, early September, so pretty recently.
All right, so yeah, we had a chat about Quanji earlier than that.
But that was the whole purpose of the extra funding, was to go get them, go get the 20% plus month-on-month growth accelerated even further, really. One point, though, that's interesting, and we talked about this pre-recording, but we should probably pick up on, is this issue of experience of personnel in financial technology. And we kind of circulated around it briefly just earlier as well. I think that's quite important, and certainly in terms of both the angels we've got in Quanji, who admittedly I know, but also more independent external funds. The fact that you've at least got one person who's been in it for a substantial length of time is very valuable, both by the specific experience and by the value add seen to investors. Yeah. So I, when persuading FX brokers, partners to work with us, rock up and quite truthfully say, look, I did this previous company. I was a MLRO, a money laundering reporting officer for an entity regulated by the FCA in exactly the same way as you. I know your pain. I know your concerns. Compliance being such a hot topic, that really helps convert the biz dev sale in that case.
No, absolutely. I mean, I have the feel with you, not too many, but there's a few now, a good few, that you guys are turning into a real business with real experience, which is separated by quite a chasm from the average fintech. So, for example, regulation. And again, just on the gossip channel, someone was telling me about a fintech, to remain nameless, that's got problems with the FCA. And having spent 30 years in the city, I just put my head in my hands, because you're screwed. You can't mess around with a regulator, you know? That you can have this sort of startup mentality, but hey, we're wonderful. Hey, we're going to steamroll it. Good luck. You know, but you know, because you've been there, that you need to do the regulation, whether you're a big, boring incumbent or whether you're a young, sexy startup.
Well, there are, however, innovations and business models that, whilst sitting in the regulation, do kind of shake it up, as you've talked about, in your own, you know, Bitcoin equivalents, massive shake-up of regulation. So,
but you still
have disruptors too.
You still have to follow the money laundering rules and all that kind of stuff.
Or you get arrested, like the guy in New York just been recently charged, hasn't he, on the Bitcoin front?
Didn't see that.
Yeah. Anyway, it was clear he was
So that's a good example. So again, there are a number of them who think that because they're young fintechs, that regulation isn't going to really apply to them. No, it applies to everybody. It's kind of almost like, you can call it the law if you like. And then coming back to the building a business and the biz devy angles, there's all those. Anyway, I was actually not trying to make some deep point here. I was just attempting to flatter you and obviously failing, which is that you have the feel, Quanji has the feel of being a business.
Yes. Yeah, well, I was going to take...
It's like a train and it's got all the wheels on and it's got some steam engine and it's actually moving down the track.
Yes, it just has, yeah. Down the runway, of course, is the analogy.
The steam train's going down the runway.
Well, no, yeah. You want the plane to kind of go down the runway and take off with a very steep growth curve and climb, I guess, is the analogy.
So are you on the runway, near the end of the runway, over the trees at the end of the runway?
We're just taking off on the runway, off the end of the runway. Potentially, I think you might be being a bit too narrow-minded on the...
I'm always narrow-minded. It's my favourite hobby.
No, on the fintech success or not, because there are big, substantial, growing businesses who've got big footholds in either my... around my FX world. Like the TransferWise famous example. Currency Cloud as well, but also more broadly, the funding circles, the seeders, all of these, where they've all got experienced people who have had time in whatever industry subset it is, but they're well off and running. You know, there are much more mature businesses than Quanji out there, having started in the new fintech wave, probably more than 2 years ago, to Eddie's point as well. Certainly TransferWise is older than that.
Yes, so it's a good point, and I am hoist with my own petard, and it's part of the problem of using the word fintech without enough subdivisions. So again, as we were talking earlier, there are some mature businesses out there that are being very successful, and they are just these days a business, and they are well reported in the media. They tend to have raised eight-figure millions. They're very well known about, they're very easy to write about. Hey, this FX business, we do FX transfers 10 times cheaper. Oh, I get it. Okay. So those, you're quite right. And actually almost kind of, I wasn't thinking of those so much. What I was thinking more of is in the less obvious to the mainstream media areas of financial services, where it's less visible, where perhaps arguably there's less low-hanging fruit. Yeah. They're still further down the curve. So Eddie's comment about we're 2 years through a 10-year journey probably applies to the majority of the businesses I've been meeting in the last few months.
Yeah, fair enough. Anyway,
I mean, the point is almost, once your aeroplane has taken off, once your steam train has taken off the runway and is in the skies flying around, well, then it almost arguably becomes a business just like any other.
Yeah.
And you become a mature industry then, don't you? Oh, yeah, so crowdfunding in 10 years' time. Oh, yeah, there's crowdfunding.
Yeah, and it's ahead in the US versus the UK. Yes. More mature, many more kind of pension funds and equivalents going into that as an asset, et cetera, et cetera.
So I guess you've got the startup phase, and then you've got the scale-up phase, which is where you're really taking off into the sky, and then almost you're kind of... You're not a startup anymore, are you?
Well, and I was going to make a comment to this, going back to the personal experience. Certainly nowhere near this in Quanji, but one thing in Exaris I, with hindsight, a wonderful thing, should have done is leave sooner. The point being, skill sets lie in a particular area. In my case, it's kind of quick and dirty, fix it good enough, keep moving very fast. Yeah, but as a business gets bigger, you have to slow down, be more precise, so that maybe a compliance issue doesn't become tricky. And ultimately, founders have to give up their baby and hand it over to the kind of mature managers.
Yes.
And whilst it wasn't my baby and I perhaps wasn't too wedded to it in that respect, it would have been sensible to get on with it a couple of years quicker than I did. It took about 9-10 years before I moved on in that case.
Well, again, I think it's part of the industry maturing, and also all of us are maturing just by virtue of going to bed and getting up in the next day. We get a bit older. Eventually, you work out what you enjoy doing and which position on the pitch you play best. So in my case, if I look at my career, I've been very good at fixing problems, innovating, creating things, but I get incredibly bored when it's a sausage machine, when all I've got to do is turn up tomorrow and crank the handle in exactly the same way as I did yesterday. Then for me, it's time to go on and do something else and pass it to somebody else.
Which is a bit like another kind of word of advice to anybody who's really early in their fintech career here is, particularly around Exaris, I've seen the people in various startup businesses around that particular sector at the time, prepay, versus the people who went to work for the monoliths, if you like, the Visas and the MasterCards. All nice people, but they're very different styles of people. And you've got to figure out your own personal fit. So there are people who want the supposed, and I don't really believe it, stability of the big organisation. But hey, by the way, you can get fired without knowing it's coming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway.
The apparent.
Yes. Versus seeing absolutely what's coming. You know, I've got enough cash to last 2 months or whatever it may be, at full visibility if it is your own thing. And maybe that's control freakery versus... And it is more stressful, but people fit in different ways. That's all right.
Well, I think it comes back to your core point, which is very well made, because we've all seen it, which is that the key to a business is the people, whether they're your investors on one side or your salesmen or your developers or that kind of thing, and managing all those. And of course, at the center of all that is managing yourself.
And learning from your mistakes.
Learning from mistakes. I never make any mistakes. I'm okay that way. But the problem is I never learn, actually. This could be the reason I've never learned.
Well, that wouldn't be something to, as an answer to, I've been asked that a few times by angels / bigger VCs who we're yet to get to in the Quanji case. That's not the answer. The answer is always, pick two or three things that you highlight. One of which was the personal fit kind of versus style of the business as it matures, I just told you. The other, which would be make sure you've got enough demand people early enough in the business, not just tech, which was an Exaris mistake. not a Kwanji mistake. And then it's, yeah, the people issues about making sure you really focus on that.
Yes, obviously, it depends who you're kind of, as it were, interviewing with. I mean, you're quite right in that there is this kind of political correctness these days. And before you go to meet a VC, you might as well find a blog that says five things you have to say to VCs and say it. Personally, when I've interviewed people in the past, anybody that's given me, quotes, the right answer.
Well, yeah.
And clearly they've practiced it in front of the mirror.
Yeah.
I try and sort of drill through that. So time is going on rapidly. Having talked about, in a sense, having seen the fintech scene for the last dozen years, where do you think it's going in the next few? We've talked about the fact that we've got a bunch of aeroplanes that are flying around in the sky and they're just mature businesses like any other, in a sense, although they're doing things in a sort of slightly newer, slightly sexier way. What about the rest of it?
Yeah, I was intrigued when we prepared for this area because I'm slightly nervous.
I didn't prepare for it, well, you see. I'm such an amateur.
No, I don't feel the world's greatest sage. As I've said, I'm not the ideas man here. So I don't per se have a big vision for the future of British or global financial technology. I think the main disruptor argument of a wave of businesses of various maturity in various countries shaking up the status quo has been said before, but is really starting to execute. Also, I think it's going to take a lot longer than every little upstart fintech business thinks it will, certainly more than the 8 years left on Eddie's 10-year cycle. So as an example, he ran in a thing about what happens when Bitcoin becomes the next reserve currency, which is fine as a thought process, but in terms of time, is
tell your grandchildren.
century out. So it's all very well to vision out that far, but I'm not sure I have much to add in that long-term horizon.
Well, I think you're being very unfair to yourself, actually, because, I mean, certainly, if you know, going back to interviews, if this was an interview, I would give you a tick for you saying you're not a sage, because I don't trust anybody who says they are a sage. And actually, to tell you the truth, nobody is a sage in this changing world, so the ones that are just sort of deluding themselves. And thinking back to episode 006 with John Shaw from Direct Line, who's head of innovation there, one of the things that he hates is blue sky thinking, because it's so utterly impractical, as you say. It's like, oh, imagine Bitcoin's taking over all the world, and there's global peace, and there's no wars, and no cancer. Yeah, okay. Whereas, actually doing his innovation and R&D gig, it's more about prototyping stuff. Is this a good idea? Let's test it a bit. Let's see how we can get it out there. Oh, it's catching on. How to industrialize it. He's got a much more practical focus.
Yeah, one thing we haven't talked about much, which is certainly not deliberate, is listen to your customers. You know, the customer feedback, which is what you're alluding to there.
Yeah.
Once you've hypothesized something, get it out quick and dirty. Listen, again, it's lean methodology, but absolutely the point. We're getting feedback in Kwanji about particular payment flows that we are working to support coming through loud and clear, things that don't particularly exist in the kind of FX bank transfer world, which will be future product launches. You know, they're the ones that know best. You have to hypothesize to a point of launch and then learn
absolutely and
quickly
of course,
from your customers.
I entirely buy that. And when I'm sort of spending my life giving free advice to young fintechs, I always bang on the same thing, especially those that haven't realized that a business is about making people happy and then they give you some money in return, just keeping it simple rather than complicated.
Yeah.
Set against that, I almost never hear the opposite principle, which is basically don't listen to them too much. So in the early stage, just finishing off on this as a point, in the early stage of a fintech, you can have client number one who says, oh yeah, I'd like it blue and I'd like the wheels square. And the client number two wants it red and wants the wheels triangle. And before you know it, you don't end up with a product. You end up with sort of basically a Savile Row model, which is fine if you want to do that, where every suit is different.
Yeah? That can be very profitable. You know, software
exactly.
Dev bespoke for banks, as an example.
Exactly. So that's a deliberate decision that has to be made, which is, am I going to be in the tailor-made thing where everything is a different gig, going back to your consultancy origins, you know,
there's some theme
to it. All the suits kind of look the same, but actually their fit is slightly different. So are you going down that over-customized route, or customized route perhaps, or are you going to go down the, look, we need to get a good app which keeps 90% of SMEs happy when they're trading with Africa or internationally.
Yeah.
In which case, you've got to listen to the clients, but also sometimes you need the courage of your vision and conviction and, yeah, okay, I hear what you say, but do you know that this isn't for you then?
Yes, and we, more leisurely than I, have certainly done that in the Kwanji example, and I absolutely understand where you're going.
So that's a useful thing to finish off on, which is the risk of listening too much, which everybody encourages you to, is that you end up sort of producing everything different for every client and you never have one product, which particularly if you're going down the B2C route and you want thousands or millions of clients, you need to have one product because you can't have a million. Customizable. Good. Thank you very much, Sir William. I look forward to seeing where Kwanji is going and I look forward to getting in the next investment round of your third one, because by then you'll have perfected it all and it will happen immediately.
That valuation is going to be way higher than it is at the moment.
Oh dear. Thanks very much, William. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts for new episodes. Live long and prosper. We could sit in a band around.
day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.